Support for the Projection Booth podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of the Projection Booth and thousands of other podcasts on the go without downloading or syncing. Stitcher instantly delivers episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone and Android app stores or on the web at stitcher.com/booth.
Meet little Melvin. He's a 90-pound weakling. Everyone hated Melvin.
I'm gonna take this mop and shove it down your throat.
They teased him.
I wanna do it with you.
Okay.
They taunted him. They tormented him until he had a horrifying accident and fell into a vat of nuclear waste. Transforming little Melvin into a hideously deformed creature of superhuman size and strength. Became the Toxic Avenger. The first superhero born out of nuclear waste. Yes, the muggers and the rapists didn't know what law and order was until the Toxic Avenger came to town.
Holy shit!
I don't know what it was, but it saved my life.
All right, everybody, drop your tacos or I'll blow your brains out.
The vandals and the perverts had their way with the little people of Tromaville until the Toxic Avenger ripped them apart. The Toxic Avenger. His face is so terrifying. We can't show it to you now. You'll have to see the movie for yourself. The Toxic Avenger can bend steel with his bare hands.
Oh, we're all a kid.
Get it?
Leap small cars in a single bound. He crushes drug pushers. Smashes hit and run drivers. And gives all criminals their just desserts. The Toxic Avenger.
He's a hero.
He's a fighter. He's a lover.
Well, Melvin, you're beautiful.
The good citizens love him. The fat and corrupt hate him.
Kill that bastard for me. You gotta kill him.
Yeah.
Will he survive? For incredible, explosive action, you must see the Toxic Avenger. He's a different kind of hero. The Toxic Avenger is coming to your town. Look out.
Welcome to the Projection Booth. I'm Rob St. Mary, and joining me is co-host Mike White.
You're stressing me, Rob. You're stressing me.
When am I not? Well, this week we're looking at Lloyd Kaufman's The Toxic Avenger. That's right, the key film in the creation of Troma, that scrappy little indie film company known for gory, cartoony, sexy fun. This 1984 film tells the tale of 90-pound weakling health club janitor Melvin, who gets sent via swan dive into a vat of toxic waste and comes out a superhero bent on cleaning up the streets with the aid of his trusty mop. The Toxic Avenger has gone on to be somewhat of a cult classic. Toxie, as he is affectionately called, is sort of Troma's Mickey Mouse, spawning four films, a children's cartoon show, comic books, and a line of children's toys. And imagine that, all from a film that features a kid losing his head. Literally, at least in this first one. But of course, there's a lot more to it than that, and that's why we're talking about it today. So, Mike, I just want to put this out there. May seem a bit too much of a fanboy when it comes to Troma or Toxie or Lloyd Kaufman, who's our special guest this week, but there is a reason. So I wanted you to know, and for everyone else to know what that is. And that reason is that because Troma, Toxie, and Lloyd Kaufman himself all helped to maintain my sanity. You see, back when I was about 19, made a little film here in Detroit on 16 millimeter, vampire film called Tainted. And Lloyd's company was kind enough to say, you know what, people might actually want to see this. So we signed a distribution deal with them, became friends, and it was released. And so ever since then, I'm indebted to Lloyd and company for helping put the film out that probably would be sitting in a closet somewhere and nobody would have seen beyond the screenings that I had here in Detroit back in 1998. But aside from that, Mike, do you remember the first time you saw The Toxic Avenger? I think myself, it was probably in high school, probably just picked it up because I remember that box art at the video store.
Well, for me, I saw it when it was on cable. And I always want to say that I saw it on USA Network, but I know that can't be right because I saw the uncut version. And I actually, God, I'm going to sound like such a prude. I actually turned it off when they ran over we're talking about the kid that loses his head. When they run over the kid's head and take Polaroid pictures of it, for some reason that just absolutely disgusted me. Not just, you know, didn't make me nauseous, but it just, I felt morally outraged by that. So it took me, that was probably back in the late 80s, and it took me all the way up until 2012 before I finally sat down and watched The Toxic Avenger all the way through.
Which is amazing to me because, you know, you are one of those people who have seen all kinds of bizarre films, all kinds of cult films. Obviously, you write about it in the fanzine and everything you do here with the projection booth as well. And it just kind of amazes me that you've never seen it all the way through.
I know. I mean, I've seen a lot of other films that Troma has released, but I generally tend to stay away from the films that Lloyd and company make. I tend to stick with the ones that they distribute. So, I mean, I was a huge fan of Surf Nazis Must Die in high school. Love that movie. And then since then, you know, Cannibal the Musical and some other films that they've released. But yeah, just for some reason, I stay away from the actual, you know, Sergeant Kabuki Man, Toxic Avenger, those kind of flicks. I don't know what it is.
Well, let's kind of get into it a little bit. You know, the idea really is kind of simple, you know, when you think about it. It's sort of a take, I don't know, I mean, what do you think? Sort of a take Frankenstein in a way?
I suppose so. I mean, obviously not as much as Frankenhooker, but yeah, definitely some Frankenstein to it. Or I don't want to say Jekyll and Hyde because there's not really the switch back and forth, but definitely that Charles Atlas 90-pound weakling to a, you know, muscle man. But I love that it's toxic waste that turns him into the creature that he is. Just that whole thing, you know, the environmentalism of the early 80s. And personally, I'm a big fan of Modern Problems, the Chevy Chase movie that's absolutely horrific, and I used to watch that on cable all the time. So that was toxic waste that turned him into a mind reading psychic. I think he had telekinesis. I just remember him making a guy's nose bleed horrifically. That scene was pretty disgusting. So, but yeah, I like Melvin and his little tutu and gets transformed and he's still got the tutu on for the rest of the film.
Well, of course, because he's an artiste and he likes ballet. So environmentalism, obviously, this is the time when environmentalism was just kind of starting. Like, it's not sort of been co-opted like it kind of is today, and it's become a commercial aspect, actually. This is pre-Chernobyl, 84, but there were still concerns with things like Three Mile Island, which, of course, Troma took on with Class of Nukem High and things like that. But this was just coming in. And then I think the other thing is we talked about with him being a janitor at a health club is I don't really know if you weren't around in the 80s, like how big sort of like health club culture was.
Oh, yeah. Well, for God's sakes, John Travolta was in a movie about aerobics classes. So, you know, whenever he's in something that is, you know, it's either the beginning or tapping right onto a trend. So, you know, if John Travolta's in something, you know that there's something going on.
Well, that's true. You know, Saturday Night Fever, of course, which there is a Lloyd connection you'll hear about in a little bit. Disco, obviously. Urban Cowboy.
Yeah.
Country music.
We had it was funny. We had a place in Riverview that was a discotheque. Back when Saturday Night Fever was big, it switched over and had a mechanical bull when Urban Cowboy was big. I wish I could say that it turned into a gym, an aerobics place, when that Jamie Lee Curtis movie came out. But unfortunately, they went out of business before that.
You know, this is the whole era of the Jane Fonda workout. The idea that people are going to do aerobics and then VHS comes in and we're going to sell you workout tapes. So that's kind of interesting. And I think that the idea of health clubs and working out and all that stuff also plays into this, as we were talking about the idea of the 90-pound weakling into the muscle man, but also the transformation of body mortification, things like that. I mean, just getting into the idea of transforming into someone or something else.
Yeah, we should also say, you know, 1980s, Reagan appoints James Watt as the Secretary of Interior, who is openly hostile to environmentalism. So that's also something that they were kind of, you know, tapping into the zeitgeist of that. I mean, I remember not necessarily the news back on HBO, just constantly skewering Watt and got somebody that was under him that they would call Dioxin Dolly. So that was environmentalism definitely had been around, obviously, since the 60s, and we had the ironized Cody commercial in the 70s. But yeah, this was kind of almost a little bit of backlash against the status quo, against the administration, with them saying, oh, don't worry about this kind of stuff, and Lloyd and company kind of taking on the political agenda of the day, which I thought was great.
I love also the fact that there are certain things that are obvious touchstones for environmental degradation of the 80s in the film. You know, obviously the concern about nuclear waste, toxic waste, things like that. But I love the scene where he's walking through the dump that Toxie lives in eventually when he leaves his mother's house because his mom can't deal with him. So he gets this little, you know, creates this little shack in the dump, and he's walking through and you see his feet, and there's styrofoam McDonald's containers, which we haven't probably seen in 25 years now. And there's a copy of a Richard Nixon book, I think it was, that's in with all the garbage. So a little political jab right there from Lloyd and Company. So it's kind of fun. You know, the thing that I really like about this film too, and I don't think it's sort of an overt idea. I think it's sort of a thing that runs under the story. It's kind of a subtext, is that Toxie has this thing where when he's around evil, he gets mean and has to destroy the evil people. And what it is in the beginning, you see Mark Torgel, who plays Melvin, turn into the Toxic Avenger and all this. But there's a time in there before he kind of fully embraces himself as the Toxic Avenger. It's sort of this difficult sort of, I guess, maybe a puberty period or something. But the idea that I think is really interesting is when he embraces this part of himself fully, is that that's when he's able to really be a good person and have impact and to live in a way. Kind of reminds me a little bit in the same sort of theme as what John Waters does, especially in his films in the 70s, where it's those who sort of embrace their freak side, those who are not constrained by their freak side or feel bad about the fact that society doesn't necessarily like their freak side, that they're the ones who ultimately end up winning in the end.
Yeah, and he was definitely doing that in a much more even-handed way during those films than he was in the one with Tracy Ullman and Johnny Knoxville, where it was just like, we are outside of society and we are all in your face about it, where back in, you know, Pink Flamingos, it was, we're the filthiest people in the world and we don't care about anyone else.
And I think that when you get into a lot of the films that Lloyd does, I think this is sort of a theme that seems to run through it. It's those who embrace, you know, their authentic self, even if it's not in line with what society has set forward, they're the ones who ultimately win in the end.
Yeah, I like how he kind of deals with the people on the fringe, even when it comes to the actors that he uses throughout his films, you know, going on to some of the sequels and everything. The folks that he tends to use are ones that are, you know, not necessarily mainstream folks. So I'm glad about that. But yeah, I definitely like that we're getting that transformation. It's funny that you say that there was a puberty period in here, because, I mean, when he's changing from Melvin into Toxie, you've got his mother outside listening, thinking outside the bathroom door, thinking that he's masturbating.
Melvin, he must have finally reached puberty.
So it is time for Melvin to finally step up into these much larger shoes and become that person that he should be, that he's got inside of him, that he can transform into. Like I was saying, it was kind of, for me, almost more of a Jekyll and Hyde thing, that he's unleashing that inner id. But it's funny that he's so much better as Toxie. You know, there's not that kind of, you know, evilness to him. Yes, he does go a little overboard sometimes when it comes to dealing with evildoers. But I also like that he's not necessarily out there just getting his revenge. He actually does get his revenge in the film, but it's kind of secondary to him cleaning up Tromaville and just making the world a better place.
Taking a look at the plot of the film, basically we have Melvin, he's the mop boy at the local gym. He's obviously this nerdy misfit who everyone picks on, no one really likes. His boss doesn't really respect him very much. There seems to be a group, two couples actually, who are regulars at the gym is what we get to understand. And they're the hip, cool, sexy people, but they're also really disturbed and demented.
Julie, you smell something?
Ooh, pee you! What's that stink?
Gee, that's funny. I don't smell nothing.
Melvin, clean up the toilet. It stinks over here.
Okay, I'll be right there.
Look what you did, you fucking asshole!
Yeah, you fucking asshole!
Hey, what are you, retarded?
Huh, retarded?
I'm sorry!
Sorry, huh?
You want me to go and get a fucking disease?
Yeah, you wanted to go and get a fucking disease?
I didn't mean it!
Oh, I didn't mean it!
Next time you fuck with me, I'm gonna take this mop and shove it down your throat.
But the thing that I like about him is that Lloyd gives them weird names.
Yeah, and I love those folks. They are great to, well, obviously, I was enjoying the females quite a bit. It was nice to see, you know, the girls back in the day when they had, you know, they were all natural and rather than kind of being made up the way that they are. But yeah, I love Bozo, especially is great. Bozo and is his partner's name Slug, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, they are great. They are, and all four of them are so bloodthirsty that their hobby is, as we were saying earlier, going out and hitting people with their car and taking photos of them. And so they have this whole like point-based system, kind of Death Race 2000-ish, of going out and killing people and then taking these photos. And then the photos end up getting the girls really hot and they masturbate to the picture. So it's like, okay, great.
Yeah, it's a bit much. That's a, you know, sort of Death Race 2000 meets Crash or something.
Right.
Do we the points, the rules, what are they?
Okay, let me see if I can remember the whole list. Now, Jews, Womps, Niggers, and Chinks. They're all worth 25 points. But Puerto Ricans, they're worth 30 points. Now, kids under 12, they're worth double points.
Skippy, don't forget your helmet.
Okay, sis.
Be careful out there.
Julie, does it count if I graze them?
But I destroy them. Bozo, I want them dead.
Now we're gonna get them. Come on, come on, come on. Where the fuck is everybody? Where the fuck is everybody?
As the plot goes on, Melvin gets these people just keep picking on him, and he ends up, you know, doing the swan dive out the window into the vat of toxic waste. And, you know, what's interesting is there seems to be a point after he comes back as the Toxic Avenger and gets some level of, I guess, justice, as you would say, within the context of this film, with the kid who gets his head crushed, as we talked about that. You turned it off before years ago, that they kind of go away. It seems like the film kind of is written where there's sort of like two sort of plot lines for the Toxic Avenger to work on. There's the revenge on the personal level. And then, as you were saying, there seems to be this whole thing with like Nazi cops and street thugs and a corrupt government system.
Yeah, Cigarface, one of the best character names ever, one of the thugs out there. And yeah, you've got the criminals going all the way up into and including the mayor, which is good that Toxie is there, because there's something evil that lurks in the heart of Tromaville.
You know, and corrupt mayors, we know nothing about that here in Detroit.
No, not at all.
No, we've never had corrupt mayors. No, not at all.
No.
And we've never had a mayor that was in with the Klan back in the 20s. That's amazing.
No.
Detroit has never had corrupt mayors or a Klan-loving mayor either. It's amazing.
Mm-mm. Haven't had African-American mayors who were supporting apartheid. Nothing like that.
Nope, not at all. See, it's because Toxie is here because he lives on Zug Island. So that's how it works.
Mm-hmm.
Mayor,
take a look. Our monster made a little bit of a mistake. You can't go around dry cleaning little old ladies. The public won't stand for it. We can kill him now with no flack from anybody.
9-9. Bad news, Mayor. That little old lady was hardly a pillar of the community. In fact, she was head of an international white slavery ring. And she had a police record a mile long.
We gotta cover this up. If it ever gets out to the press, we're sunk. And I want you to do me a favor. Kill that bastard for me. You gotta kill him.
Yes, mein Führer. Mein Mayor.
As everything sort of works out with Toxie, the idea also in there is he falls in love with a girl, Sarah, in this film. And we'll talk about how these names change later. Sarah in this film is a blind woman that he meets at a Mexican restaurant that's being held up, who, you know, Toxie comes and gets rid of the bad guys. And I thought that was really interesting, the idea that that you would have a female romantic interest who would fall in love with him because she can't see what he looks like.
Well, Melvin, you're beautiful. You're a beautiful person. You're so muscular. It's been 2 years since I've touched a man.
What are you doing to me? I've never felt like this before.
Right. And again, I guess that kind of speaks to the Frankenstein theory that you're putting forth. I mean, it reminded me a lot of the old man, the blind man in the shack when he is, you know, that's the only friend that Frankenstein has, or the monster, I should say, has, is that blind guy. And, you know, he can look past Frankenstein's exterior and see the goodness that is in his heart, or at least the, you know, the lack of malice that is inside of the creature's heart. Yeah, so that was nice that they kind of have a little homage.
The Toxic Avenger as a film, in terms of the trauma aesthetic, kind of like sits in this spot where everything sort of pivots. If you look at the history of the library, and I'm not talking about the films that are distributed that they pick up, because obviously before this you had Bloodsucking Freaks, which was one of the first films that Troma put out in the mid-late 70s. But when we're talking about the films that Lloyd Kaufman and Michael Herz produced, wrote, and directed, The Toxic Avenger is sort of that pivot point where things change. Before that, Troma had been known in the late 70s or early 80s for doing a series of sort of like sexy comedies that I think they did 4 or 5 of them. They were sort of like Porky's before Porky's was Porky's, you know what I mean? And then after you get The Toxic Avenger, it seems like everything, which still includes sort of that sexy comedy idea, but everything goes into a horror vein. We get more into gore, we get into blood and guts. And as you get further to today, you know, the modern era of Lloyd's work, now almost 40 years on, it's so dark, so cynical, so angry. And I just wanted to sort of see, you know, you had said that you had seen some of his stuff, or were you talking about your knowledge of Troma is mostly based on the stuff that they release, and sort of what you think about sort of this shift that you see throughout the catalog?
Yeah, it's mostly based on the stuff that they release. I mean, I've kept up with Lloyd. I mean, if there's one thing that Lloyd Kaufman is absolutely fantastic about, it is promotion, and definitely self-promotion. So I appreciated finally being able to see The Toxic Avenger. And I have to say, just watching it the one time all the way through, it really did leave a mark. I mean, because that was probably a few months ago when I sat down and watched it. And then when I was thinking back on it, I could remember pretty much the exact order of all the scenes and what happens. And just because there are so many good set pieces in the film, and I think that they did themselves a real service by having those. I mean, the fight with Cigar Face, the fight inside of the Mexican restaurant. I mean, there are some actual really strong images that you get too. I mean, what happens to Julie dog, it's like, okay, yeah, I'll never get that image out of my head now. Thank you very much. So, I mean, they do a good job with as far as giving us a really clear, easy to follow story and making Toxie very much a hero that I want to believe in.
Just to clarify a point, Julie's the one who torments him, and then Sarah's the blind girl he falls in love with.
Oh, my bad. Sarah, the blind girl.
Yeah, there you go. The thing is like, since you have paid attention, you know, looking at sort of the arc of the stuff. I think the thing that's really interesting with sort of what Troma represents as a mirror, I think, because it is this last bastion of really sort of like raw personal film made really cheap, is that it kind of, Lloyd's films kind of reflect back his attitude, I think. And this is something that I think I can kind of speak on, like knowing him, I've known him like over a decade. His films kind of reflect back, I think, his personal things that are going on, but also his attitude with the business he's in at that time. I think that when you get later in, when you get into like, you know, Toxic Avenger 4, or you get into the later stuff, it's almost like he's very angry that other independent filmmakers are no longer around. The other companies that were around him at the time have all been sort of done away with by the big conglomerates. And he often talks about this, and whenever you see him in interviews, is that I think he's getting more and more upset that it's so hard for him to survive as a businessman and an artist in a world that had seemed to have so much room for independence at the time when he started back in the 70s.
Yeah, we had a chance to talk to the creator of The Toxic Avenger, Lloyd Kaufman, about the film and how the early days of Troma came about. I was really hoping that we could talk to Samuel Weill, since he is credited for co-directing the film, but Rob assures me that it was actually Lloyd that was co-directing at this time. So we're going to take a break. We'll roll that interview, and then when we come back to the projection booth, we'll be talking more about The Toxic Avenger.
Everyone wants to spice things up in the bedroom. Here's an offer you won't want to miss. For a limited time, you'll get 50% off just about any one item at adamandeve.com. Yes, get 50% off when you use the coupon code BOOTH at checkout, as in John Wilkes Powers or the Projection Booth. But that's not all. You'll also receive 3 free adult DVDs and free shipping on your entire order. Too good to be true? It's not. Check out adamandeve.com today for this special offer. Once again, that coupon code is BOOTH at adamandeve.com.
Follows.net.
I'm here with Bill Byforce and Mr. Chris to tell you a little bit about Outside the Cinema.
All right, Reverend Scott, take us to church.
What can we expect to find from a typical show?
2 hours of just random blabber.
Is there anyone's coattails you rode in on to popularity?
I'm the guy that fucking burns the coattails and then pisses on them.
You review all these exploitation, horror, comedy, cult, and often all-around terrible movies. You must have a strong driving force that keeps you going.
Ego.
I don't know if I've heard you say that before.
Yeah, I've been saying that for a while.
Really?
I have been saying that for a while. Also, I'm high on smack.
Well, it's definitely working for you guys. People are coming out in droves to support you on iTunes.
We just the other day got a one-star review on iTunes.
Well, that is one star too many. Let me tell you, the worst fucking piece of shit I've ever heard.
This has been great, guys.
Thanks, Scott. That was good. Oh, he's got you crying over there.
I'm good for the rest of the year.
Nice.
That was too much.
You don't see me, do you?
Just a photo, just a still photo.
Okay, because I'm totally naked and I've
got. Yeah, you should probably put on some pants.
I have a huge erection, so you don't see that.
It looks like it's almost tickling your chin. It's so big.
Well, maybe I'm going to turn off the camera then.
Okay, there you go.
I need the wide-angle lens. I'm switching to the very wide-angle lens.
There you go. There you go. Just wanted to talk about some of the films, some of the work you're doing, and all that stuff. And
well, you know, the highlight of my career, as Mike probably knows, is that Troma was able to buy the rights to Tainted, a movie made in the Detroit area. It's been downhill ever since. Let me tell you.
Yeah, I bet. I bet, Lloyd. So, talking about how...
Who made that film? Who made Tainted?
I did. I was producer.
Hey, see, Mike, look at that. Who would knew? Who knew? What a coincidence that the highlight of my career was all thanks to Mr. Robert St. Mary.
Yeah. Thank you, Lloyd.
Mike White makes pretty good movies, too, actually. You did one with Jennifer Aniston, as I recall, called
the
Good Girl.
The Good Girl.
And what was the Chuck and Buck?
Chuck and Buck, yep.
Yeah, that was good stuff. What are you doing recently, though? What's new?
Just working with Rob, you know, on this podcast.
Well, that's a big step up from Chuck and Buck.
Oh, yeah. It pays a lot better, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, I'm very jealous. I know. Right there in the same refrigerator carton. Well, anyway, I'll shut up now. So you guys should be asking the questions.
When you started out, when you came out of Yale, you started making your own films, and then you got hooked up.
I was making my own damn movies.
That's right.
Make your own damn movie.
Exactly. And you started working with John G. Avildsen on some of his early stuff, Joe and Rocky and that. How did you originally get hooked up with him?
Well, I wouldn't say hooked up is quite the word. I mean, we've been very intimate, but we've never hooked up. I wanted to, but John G. Avildsen is not... you know, he doesn't like men. You should get that out of the way first. So we've never hooked up. But I was lucky enough to be cleaning toilets or doing shit work at a small company called Canon. And John was in, I was actually rewinding film for people. In those days, we worked with something with sprocket holes and we didn't have computers and no MTV. It was awful. And so I was rewinding stuff for John. And then I got lucky enough, he started to make a movie called Joe. And I got lucky enough one day to get to be a production assistant. They needed an extra hand. And I remember the first section, I'm really boring you, but the first day I got, but to me it's very meaningful. The second I got there, John was setting up a shot in a furnace or a shot of a furnace. And Peter Boyle, whose movie debut that Joe was in the thing. And I went, hey, this looks really cool. This looks like a really cool shot. This looks like something one of, Chabrol or one of the Cinema Verite guys would do. And from the Calle Cinema. So I went up to the camera and I looked through the lens. I just walked right up, looked through the lens. My first 10 minutes on the set. And, Allison didn't care, but it was a union crew. And they were apoplectic. Some camera, I don't know who hit me, who got me first, but this was not done by a non-union. You didn't just go up and look in the cameraman's camera. So, but I saw that Avildsen was really good, and I had a hunch. So I attached myself to him, and I did some free work for him. After Joe, he was organizing his next gig. And it turned out to be Cry Uncle, which is a brilliant, brilliant film. Nobody knows about it, but it's terrific. Troma distributes it. And I got on that film. And so Avildsen and Saturday Night Fever, which Avildsen was originally going to direct, and he put me on that movie. That movie and Avildsen's Rocky and Cry Uncle and Joe were my film school, basically. But Avildsen left... Saturday Night Fever, and John Badham came in, equally as talented, and also a great guy. And I learned a lot from him. So the Avildsen and the Badham were basically my film school, as well as being a foot fetishist.
Also during that time, wasn't it during Rocky that you met the lovely Pat Kaufman, or was it before that?
No, actually I met Pat when I was working on the horrendous Big Gus What's the Fuss. I just finished Sugar Cookies and was going to go to Israel to make Big Gus What's the Fuss. And I met her on one of our investors' yachts. And Pat was a guest. I hate boats, but I finally gave in. He kept asking me. So I went to the boat for the weekend. It was in West Hampton, and the boat slept six people. So I finally had to give in, and I went. And I was lucky enough that Pat was there that same weekend, and she happened to be wearing a very small bikini, pink. I was stricken. I was pretty hot myself, let me tell you. I was wearing this like really tight spandex. Sorry.
You said you were working for Canon. Did you have much contact with like Golan and Globus and those guys?
This was before Golden Globus. This was Cannon started with a little company run by a teeny weeny little company, Dennis Friedlander and Chris Dewey. And they were distributing movies like Inga, and they were also taking movies that were sort of almost finished and then finishing them and kind of, and maybe they did one or two really schlocky, and I mean schlocky, sexy films or something, but they were cool. And I got lucky enough to get a little job there. And I think they got involved in the tail end of one of John Avildsen's earlier movies. And I was helping rewind. And then they had a kind of a sexy Western. It was like softcore, but it was Western or something. But they needed to shoot some insert shots. So I got to be involved in that. Some shots that they could add in either to make more sex or less sex. I can't remember. And they had the Fando Elise, which was Jodorowsky's film. They were distributing that, but they might have actually been recutting them or doing something. I'm not sure what it was. I was just rewinding.
What do you think you learned from that time working with John Avildsen and the Cannon folks that helped you as a filmmaker and then create Troma?
Well, I learned a lot from John G. Avildsen. Location filming is almost a given with a Troma movie. We don't shoot in studios. And Avildsen was a big proponent of interesting locations and the location being part of the movie and being almost like an actor, or not an actor necessarily, but close to. And he also, you know, used a lot of unknowns. He picked really talented people who became famous, but, you know, he discovered, or he introduced Stallone, among others. Paul Sorvino's first movie, Susan Sarandon's first movie, Peter Boyle's first movie. He had an eye for talent, and he is incredibly talented. So his early movies were sort of my film school, and then because Badham came on to Saturday Night Fever, and I owe my job on that to John, that was sort of my education, film school. Other than just seeing a pant load of movies and reading the Cahiers du Cinéma and being kind of brainwashed by the French Cinémathèque auteur theory while I was at Yale, that's why I'm almost at 40 years of failed filmmaking. That's why I'm underground when I could have been Michael Bay.
I'm glad you're not Michael Bay.
I would have been a good Michael Bay. I would have been a better Michael Bay than Michael Bay, let me tell you.
I don't think it would take much to be a better Michael Bay than Michael Bay, though.
You're a snob.
Yes, I am. So when you started Troma, what was your goal, and has it changed over the years?
Well, Michael Herz and I started Troma, and our idea was to be able to make movies ourselves unfettered, other than by our own lack of talent, and also perhaps to bring new independent individuals into the forefront too, to be sort of the independent movie studio and take chances on things that nobody wants to see but are movies of the future, like Cannibal the Musical or The Toxic Avenger, Blood-Sucking Freaks, whatever we've gotten involved in, which people initially didn't get, but 20 years later, Sergeant Kabuki Man, NYPD, people want to remake it.
During those early years of Troma, you were also working on other stuff. You worked on Final Countdown with Kirk Douglas, but there's one that kind of sticks out that I'd love to know more about, and I don't think you've ever really talked about it, was you were thanked at the end of My Dinner with Andre. Can you explain how you became involved with that?
Well, Louis Malle was a fan of comic books and Troma, and I think I met him through Stan Lee, maybe? Was through somebody in the world of, and Mal liked Troma. He liked our crazy stuff. But we had just done Waitress, which was about a restaurant, except that there was very little dialogue, and hardly 5 seconds would go by when you didn't have a chicken flying through the air or some kind of slapstick moment. you know, with all sort of stupid action. And my dinner with Andre was absolutely the opposite. It was all intelligent and philosophical and mind challenging stuff. So it seemed like a very interesting project. And so I was the production manager, and they wanted the, I think Louis Malle was a Directors Guild. So the film had to go Directors Guild. So they had to have a director, and they had to have, if they wanted a DGA director, they had to take one member of the union. So they picked me. I guess I was the weirdest.
So you were the production manager on it, which meant that you handled, like, what aspects?
There were two people in it. It was not my hardest job. There's two actors. There's nothing to do.
That's why I was asking sort of what the job was.
Yeah, I don't remember. My recollection was it was pretty easy. And I bought they, because they were in the union, because Mr. Mao was in the union. They had to have it. They were required, so that he wouldn't get into trouble, they were required to have a union production manager. I think that's what it was. I think. Well, somehow I fulfilled the union requirement.
You know, definitely made a few films before The Toxic Avenger. Some were, you know, minor hits, really. But Toxie really put you over the edge. Can you explain how the idea came about?
I can bore you for a long, long, long time regarding The Toxic Avenger. But it was Chaplin. We had made a series of sexy, raunchy comedies before the Porky's fad. We had done these movies like Squeeze Play and Waitress and Stuck on You and The First Turn On, which discovered Vincent D'Onofrio. And then the studios started making the same kind of raunchy movies after Porky's. The studios, except they were playing unfair. They were doing those movies with good scripts and good actors. So, that wasn't fair. So we had to leave the game and look for something else. And then we read in the trades, one of the trades, that horror as a profitable entity was doomed. So then that gave us the idea, well, let's get involved with the horror area, because whatever the experts are saying, you know, we should do the opposite. So that was kind of part of the trauma philosophy. We made a horror film, and it's just that we like comedy and satire, and so Toxie became a comedy, a disturbing comedy. That way a disturbing comedy would be the perfect way to have nobody buying a ticket, because we like to make movies to which nobody shows up. And I think with Toxic Avenger, we got just right, except that somehow, after a year, people started not only showing up, but going crazy. It was an accident.
Writing the idea for it, I mean, did you just have sort of a kernel idea, okay, this like weakling guy in toxic waste, or did you have someone who wrote the script with you? Kind of how did it all, you know, how did that part come together?
We knew we wanted to do something horror, but yet we wanted to have satire, and we wanted to have make it funny and disturbing rather than scary. And then I used to get these kind of wacko newsletters. My grandmother was kind of a commie, and so she'd give me a lot of this stuff. But I kept sort of subscribing. I don't remember, or I'd read them, or anyway, I remember reading, and I'd sort of read a lot of weird stories. But one was about toxic waste dumps taking away like time bombs. And my wife and I used to go camping, and we'd see the styrofoam McDonald's stuff all over the place, and even in the swamps and wilderness, and because it wasn't biodegradable. And the environment sort of seemed to be an interesting theme, that the fact that while people in America were going to health clubs and getting body beautiful and plastic surgery was starting to become a la mode, was more widespread, more a la mode, we were polluting. The children in Rio were dancing around, throwing radium, you know, thinking it was pixie dust, dancing around dumps, playing with the pixie dust, which was radium discarded by hospitals. So that all started to weigh on me. And I always loved Frankenstein, and I was always very upset that he didn't survive. The monster. I always liked the monster. So I would have liked to have the monster survive. In the same way with Romeo and Juliet, I always was upset that Romeo and Juliet didn't survive. So in Romeo and Juliet, I wanted them to survive. So I'm an optimist. That's how it all began. Just a wide-eyed optimist.
I think I heard once that Toxic Avenger was not the original title of the film.
No. The original title was Scenes from a Marriage by Ingmar Bergman.
But nice.
We had to change it. We had to especially get rid of the by Ingmar Bergman. So unfortunately, we weren't allowed to use by Ingmar Bergman. But I think if we had, it would have been very successful.
So did you originally change it to The Toxic Avenger by Ingmar Bergman?
We tried. We did. We tried that too, but no. So it was originally called Health Club Horror. But it became clear that we had created, it wasn't a health club horror. We had a wonderful character. And so that the movie just coalesced around this hideously deformed creature of superhuman strength with a heart of gold. And so we changed to the Toxic Avenger.
You talked a little bit about it earlier, but, you know, can you kind of explain what the reaction was when it first came out and then sort of how it started to build? I mean, what did you sort of see happen with it?
Well, nobody particularly cared for it at the very beginning. In fact, even our investor, we had some very hostile, at least one very, very hostile investor. Although Leni Riefenstahl saw the first either print or the fine cut of The Toxic Avenger, I think before it was mixed, but she did come to a screening. The great Leni Riefenstahl. So that's pretty cool. A woman who may have defecated on Hitler's head saw The Toxic Avenger and had made Triumph of the Will, of course. Not after Toxic Avenger, but well before it. So,
what was her reaction? Did she say, you know, pretty good, but not enough Nazis? Or
almost. She was like, oh, very interesting. She was very tactful. She had amazing PO, by the way. Don't tell anyone. But Leni Riefenstahl had B.O. like you wouldn't believe. And it was B.O. It wasn't swamp ass. I know the difference.
Sorry, I'm over here laughing.
Auteur theory of film, you know, Jean-Luc Godard and Eugene O'Neill, they were very much alike. Very intellectual.
Sorry, I'm just trying to gather myself. So, you said that it took a while to get going. Was there that moment though where you're just like, what happened? What kind of put it over the edge? Where you're just like, oh my gosh, people are starting to see this. And was this kind of what was the window of time where it came out before you started to realize that it kind of had legs?
The first time it actually didn't have legs; it had mops. We called them mops in those days. Movies had mops, especially Toxic Avenger. It took about a year, and one theater played it in Greenwich Village, and the people were lined up around the block, and then it went there for a long, 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 long time. And the lady who ran that theater was one of Andy Warhol's buddies, and she was French, and she actually understood the Toxic Avenger. She must have watched it. I think a lot of the people who had movie theaters didn't even watch it. They just were afraid of it because they saw the trailer or something. But she actually watched the movie, and I think she got that it was satire. So it was fun. But anyway, it went a long, long time, and then it just spread out from that one theater. And then it opened at maybe 30 or 40 theaters in New York City and in different areas around the country. It did pretty well. But then we hit the video boom, and The Toxic Avenger, I think, was the first movie of that type that came out on video, where there was sort of horror. I think up until that point, video cassette was the domain of the Jane Fonda and the self-improvement and Michael Jackson thriller. And I don't think it was known that something that had gore and horror and sex in it could sell on tape. I don't think that had been tried. And I think Vestron Video formed a separate line of, they formed a separate brand called Lightning. And I think Toxie was the first one in that line. So it was, Toxie proved that the public would embrace a movie like that in home video.
Was there any problem with the video market and censorship at that time?
Well, the problem was the MPAA, Motion Picture Association of America, the rating board. And the rating board in those days, in my opinion, and I know I'm right, would cut out more out of the independent movie than out of the movie by Sony or MGM or Disney. So with Toxic Avenger, they disemboweled it. And we couldn't get into movie theaters without an R rating. They didn't have this NCA-17. And so we had to have an R rating to get, you know, if you want 20 or 30 theaters in New York or 50, if you want to do a saturation, you're not going to get it with an NC-17 or whatever, at least in those days. So the MPA totally fucked us, I believe, in that they took like 20 minutes out of, or at least 20 minutes out of the Toxic Avenger to get to the R rating, which without which we wouldn't get it in theaters. But yet in Canada, they only took about 45 seconds out, and that was the Canadian government. And in France, 13-year-olds were allowed to see. Our rating is 16-year-olds. In France, 13-year-olds could come to the Toxic Avenger, and only 30 seconds was removed. So, you know, the MPAA, that was a big problem, because they did. It wasn't government censorship, but it was censorship by an organization controlled and operated by the small number of giant mega conglomerates.
When it was released on video, though, did you release the unrated version? Was this kind of one of the early unrated kind of films?
Well, because I could be wrong, but it came out unrated, the director's cut, as well as R-rated, both. And, of course, the unrated would sell 90% in the R-rated in the red states that were really conservative.
Toxic Avenger 2 and 3 come out a few years later. Can you kind of tell me how those came to be and what you were trying to accomplish with those two?
Well, we went to the Cannes Film Festival after the Toxic Avenger became a sort of a bit of a phenomenon. And there was this rumor that we had pre-sold the German rights for Toxic Avenger Part 2. In my wildest dreams, I'd never thought about a Toxic Avenger Part 2. But one German buyer came to our office in the Carlton Hotel, very irate, because he had heard that we had pre-sold the rights to Toxic Avenger Part 2 to one of his competitors in Germany. And I never even thought about Toxic Avenger Part 2. But he apparently talked to some other people saying there was going to be a Toxic Avenger Part 2. And then it sort of built up so that we were able to kind of tap dance a bit and improvise and say that's a very important project. We're going ahead with Toxic Avenger Part 2, and you have to pay us a lot of money. And so we got some good deals from it. And so then we decided, well, what the hell, we'll make Toxic Avenger Part 2.
That one, tone-wise, is a little bit different than the first one. It's a little more, I don't want to say kid-friendly, but it's a little more of a family film in some aspects compared.
Both two and three were, we compromised, and I regret it. And I think the reason was we had to get an R rating. We had to cut our wings because in order to get our video deals, we didn't do our own video distribution. We had to submit an R rating. So we got, there were compromises and also subject matter a bit. So I think, and I regret it because I think we would have been better off just going out without the rating.
So do you consider Part 4 to be sort of the logical sequel to the first one, or do you see it as a through line with all of them?
It's the best. Well, it is a through line. The Toxie story goes from one, Toxie, Part 1, he's a teenager, and 2 and 3, he gets older and older and he gets married, and Part 4 leads up to he and his significant other have a baby, or 2 or 3. So, but yes, 4 is still part of the narrative, but that's the best one, without a doubt.
How did you decide that that was the time around, what was it, 2000 or so, to come out with another Toxic Avenger film? And what was sort of spurring you on to do it?
I think that Michael Herz wanted to do it or something. I don't know. I just remember that a decision. I don't remember how that decision was made, to tell you the truth. But I just remember it occurred. And we were pretty, you know, Trent Haga had to write the first draft on his honeymoon. I mean, we must have been in a rush, but I don't quite remember it. I know it's in one of my books. We talk about it a bit in, I think we talk about it in one of the books. But my recollection is a decision was made and we had to move pretty fast. And I don't know why. Citizen Toxie is really good.
There was word for a little while that you were trying to do a fifth Toxic Avenger, the Toxic Twins.
Yes, we are still working on the Toxic Twins, but we have not achieved a screenplay that is either up or down to the trauma level. And we're still trying to figure out the plot lines, and we haven't really gotten there yet. But Class of Nukem High, on the other hand,
the Toxic Avenger is kind of interesting when you look at it. It also became a kids' cartoon for a while. Do you remember how the cartoon came to be?
I think the toy company made Ninja Turtles, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and they thought Turtles was going downhill. So they thought it would be a good idea to have an environmental action figure. So that's where we came in. We don't think they ever looked at the Toxic Avenger movie. We can't imagine how they could have, and then decided to make Toxie into a children's cartoon and action figure. But anyway, that's sort of how it happened. And the cartoons are great. They're terrific. The people who made the cartoons loved our movies and really caught the spirit and the satire, and were able to cut out the stuff that would be upsetting the kids. And they did a great job. It was one of the stuff is very funny.
I think as you've said before, it's the only cartoon that was created for kids that is made out of a film in which a kid is killed horribly.
That's for sure. The Toxies, if for no other reason, the Toxic Avenger is historic.
Now, you had mentioned the Class of Nukem High Redux. There's also a remake of Toxie going on as well, correct?
But Toxie is beyond us. That's a much bigger project. Akiva Goldsman and Richard Saperstein, who did all sorts of, you know, The Beautiful Mind and I Am Legend, stuff like that. And Akiva Goldsman won the Oscar for A Beautiful Mind. So they're going to make the big $100 million version of Toxic Avenger. And then we're doing the Class of Nukem High Redux. Redux is probably a stupid title, right? Shouldn't say that, probably. That just seems funny. In any event, so we're going to do that, and then it'd be kind of be the first remake that's made for no money. You know, all the remakes sort of brag about $50, $100 million big-budget remake of a movie that cost, you know, $500,000. We're going to go the other way. We're going to make the Class of Nukem High remake. It's going to be no money. It's just a remake that's even cheaper than the one that preceded it.
How did Hollywood interest come where Akiva Goldsmith and them came forward and wanted to remake the Toxic Avenger? I mean, what was the conversation like on why they wanted it?
Well, Toxie's a big deal. You know, he's like a movie star. He's not Spider-Man, but he's way up there. And Toxie's got kind of a good, you know, he's liked on the street because we're underground and we're always struggling. And so people, you know, Toxie's kind of cool. And of course, all these movie stars, you know, like Toxie. Tarantino is a fan. I mean, he's both a major director and a movie star, but he likes Toxie. You know, Toxie's got a pretty good reputation.
What have you heard in terms of them putting it together? Do you know if it's go and sort of, do you think they'll keep the same spirit or if it's going to be a little bit different than what you did?
I would imagine it'll be quite different from what we did, but it'll be good different. They've got Steve Pink, who's writing and directing it, and he's great. He did Hot Tub Time Machine. They wrote and directed that, and he also was involved with Gross Point Blank and High Fidelity. He either wrote them both or directed, or wrote one, directed. Anyway, the stuff he's been involved in is really good, and he's talented, and he gets it. You know, he's a Troma fan, and I think he will do what the same thing that people who did the Toxic Avenger musical did. You know, they were able to mainstream, and the way the cartoon people did. And that's why Toxie is so interesting, because people have successfully transferred the humor and the mood and the subversiveness of Toxie, a mild subversiveness of Toxie, to other media, and have done a great job. And they've been able to leave the extreme violence or the slapstick or the of bad taste kind of erotic stuff, leave it with Troma. And they've done a good job. The musical, the Toxic Avenger musical, is terrific. And it's been very successful. And according to David Bryan, who is a founding member of Bon Jovi, who wrote the award-winning music for Toxic Avenger, it's going to Broadway. So how cool would that be? But again, I had nothing to do with that. It's just that I think they did a wonderful job in taking out the kind of spirit, the rebellious spirit of Troma and the humor, but being able to mainstream it so that it's a lot more agreeable.
When you look back on it now, it's been almost 30 years since you did the film. It was released. What do you think about it in terms of what it says about, you know, your work or the film itself or for Troma in general? What do you think the Toxic Avenger still has to say to us?
Well, the Toxic Avenger is kind of Troma's Mickey Mouse. So he's very iconic. But my wife says that the Toxic Avenger story of parts 1 through 4 and then 5, my wife feels that that's sort of my autobiography. And so, you know, I think Toxie's pretty personal.
In sort of a way that you feel like an outsider, and you've always, or in what way do you think that is, Lloyd?
Well, you should talk to my wife. I don't really think that Toxie's my autobiography, but certainly, you know, he's very attached to his mother, and my mother was a saint. So that there are things that are within Toxie that, and I guess the sort of underground rebellion and fighting for the forces of good, idealism and sort of dumb optimism, that's sort of Toxie.
As for the future, what sort of lays out, what type of things are you planning to do next?
Well, as for the future, we've put a YouTube video. We shot something on YouTube, which kind of sums up the future. If you go to Lloyd Kaufman Homeless, I think you can dial that in, Lloyd Kaufman, K-A-U-F-M-A-N, and remember Lloyd is L-L-O-Y-D as in David. So you go Lloyd Kaufman and Homeless and plug into YouTube and you'll see the future. And also talks about some of our things like Comcast channel and the stuff we're doing to try to stay around in the future. You know, we have a Comcast channel, so if you get Comcast, you've got the free Troma on Demand channel, and we're putting up movies with YouTube. There's a Troma channel on YouTube in which you can see free movies, and Hulu has free movies from Troma, of course. So we're getting into that area, whether or not, hoping that, you know, maybe we can get in there early and build an audience so that somehow we can derive the means to keep making movies through the modern world of iTunes and Xbox and all that kind of stuff. This summer, we'll presumably shoot Class of Nukem High Redux, so we keep making movies. And you know about Father's Day. That's a movie that Astron 6 made, which Troma produced. Michael Herz and I produced it. And it's a really amazing film. Astron 6 is a group that is, you know, I think up there with Trey Parker and Matt Stone and James Gunn and Eli Roth and people like that who've sort of either been involved with our movies or we've discovered. And they're incredibly talented.
Welcome back. It was great catching up with Lloyd Kaufman, getting a chance to talk to him about those early years of Troma and the Toxic Avenger. We'll hear more from Lloyd later this year as we cover some other key films in the Troma catalog. Don't want to ruin the surprise. So that'll be fun as well, because it's always great talking to Lloyd, because he is he's quite a character, in case you didn't know.
Yeah, if he couldn't figure that out, there you go. There's proof right there.
So this film spawned four sequels, Mike. Actually, three sequels, and there's a fourth one they're currently writing. Which ones have you seen out of 1, 2, 3, and 4?
I have seen 1 and 4, but I was kind of warned away from 2 and 3.
Yeah, it's kind of funny, actually. In Toxic Avenger 4, Citizen Toxie, they actually put a front end that has a voiceover by a famous voice who you might recognize. Where
Excelsior!
That's right.
Melvin became the Toxic Avenger, the first superhero from New Jersey. Then, two rotten sequels were made. Sorry about that. This is the real sequel.
Just to give you sort of brief recaps of what goes on in Toxie 2 and 3. Toxie 2 basically picks up where the first one left off, and there's a company that comes to town called Apocalypse Inc. And Apocalypse Inc. is this, you know, big environmental polluter, and they decide that they got to get rid of Toxie and take over Tromaville, because Tromaville is sort of like the toehold to take over New York City and then the world. So it's all about corporate greed. It's all about environmental degradation once again. And what they decide to do is try to lure Toxie to Japan and try to find a technology to kill that thing inside of him, which they've now dubbed Tromatons, this chemical or thing that sets them off whenever there's evil around. So they're like, we can't be in town because Toxie will strangle us. So let's send him to Japan. So what they do is they create this fake story that actually Toxie's dad is Japanese, which I don't know why he just didn't talk to his mom. So
yes, because they do reconcile by the end of Toxic Avenger 1, so they should be speaking again.
Exactly. He ends up going to Japan, and there's this whole kind of thing with sort of like the Toxic Avenger walking around Tokyo. He learns how to sumo wrestle. And then at the time, he ends up back in Tromaville at some point and destroys Apocalypse Inc.
That sounds almost more boring than Lost in Translation by Sofia Coppola.
Yeah, you know, actually, if you could kind of like cross-cut the two, it might be an interesting film. So
I'd like to see Toxie and Bill Murray together. I think that'd be pretty great.
Yeah, that would be good. I'd like to see them play off each other. In this film, as I said, in the first movie, we have Sarah, the blind girl, right? Well, for some reason, it's Claire now. I don't know why this changed. And also, Melvin's last name changes for some reason. Like, he goes from being Melvin Ferd in the first film to being Melvin Junko, whatever that means. Maybe that plays into the Japanese thing. He's with Claire now, who has gone from being, you know, a blind woman. Yes, another blind woman. But she's definitely a lot sexier in this movie. She's got, like, she's wearing a bikini all the time. She's kind of, you know, cutesy with her hair feathered and stuff like that. You know, really model sort of in the 80s, kind of beautiful. 1989 is when that one came out. And since you're a big fan of Black Dynamite, Toxic Avenger 2, Michael Jai White's in it.
Nice.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll have to check it out.
Yeah. So he plays a karate thug that Toxie gets in a fight with. And he also has a few lines as well. He's a henchman for Apocalypse Inc. Toxie 3, 1989. Both these films were pretty much created back-to-back. If you read Lloyd Kaufman's book, and we talked a little bit about it in the interview, Lloyd kind of says in there that he shot the second one and then had all this extra stuff left over. And the video company said, well, do you have another movie? And he's like, sure. So he went out and shot a few extra things, put the whole thing together, and put out two movies back-to-back, and basically made a lot of money by doing that, because this was in the era of VHS, and they just couldn't get enough VHS tapes on the shelf. So I think they gave him some crazy amount of money to make a third one out of basically scraps that he had laying around the editing room.
Little known fact, that's exactly what happened with Back to the Future 2 and 3.
Probably right. Steven Spielberg and Bob Zemeckis are geniuses. Toxic Avenger 3, dubbed The Last Temptation of Toxie, obviously after The Last Temptation of Christ, which came out around the same time in the late 80s. Okay, so in part 2, he defeats Apocalypse Inc., once again, finds himself with nothing to do in Troma because all the evil has been purged, all the corruption is gone. But somehow, he finds out that there's a way to get Claire, his girlfriend, again, same actress, to see again. He's going to try and get a day job and make some money and move out of the dump and get the eyes fixed. He goes to work, actually, for Apocalypse Inc. I don't know how they got back. I thought they were destroyed. But anyway, Apocalypse Inc. is back. And Lloyd has Toxie going to work for them as a PR spokesman. That's right. He goes corporate. Toxie becomes a corporate sellout. And just completely gets berated by his girlfriend, doesn't like it. You know, yeah, I'm glad you fixed my eyes, but you suck because now you're a corporate hack. There's a scene in the beginning that anyone who loves movies and has worked in a video store, like myself, and I know you're a big movie guy, Mike, that there's a scene where these thugs come in from the company and start to tell the people that they're only going to be able to watch the top 20 movies that the company says is okay for you to watch.
I wonder if this is around the time when Blockbuster was pulling all the copies of Toxic Avenger and anything else that was unrated off of their shelves.
I believe that's probably the case, sir.
Hmm.
It becomes really, the third one becomes, although it is a mess, there's a lot of stuff in there about like corporate greed and environmentalism. The chairman of Apocalypse Inc. says, you know, dioxin means dollars, and they take over City Hall and turn it into a dioxin factory. That's kind of funny. And, you know, this idea of business taking over government, you know, that's just way, way 80s. Like, that would never happen today. We don't have that problem anymore at all.
Thank goodness we have purged any kind of business-government connection.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredible that we don't have that anymore. And this is kind of a Faust story. Like, if we want to look at the first film as sort of Frankenstein-esque, this is kind of like Faust, sort of like you sign a deal with the devil kind of thing. And after he becomes a corporate sellout, he finds out that the company is trying to turn everyone into Tromaville into slaves. So there's also this biblical element where you could say, okay, well, now Toxie is Moses and he's going to free the slaves of Tromaville and actually battles the devil. And in Troma fashion, the devil, it's not red.
No.
It's green.
Oh, kind of like the color of money.
Could be the case. Or it could be, as I've read elsewhere, that Troma was too cheap to buy red paint, and that's the reason why the devil is green. But I like to think that Lloyd was much more going for the symbolism on this one and decided to make the devil green because, obviously, the color of money. Or maybe he's trying to say something about the Irish. I don't know. So Toxie and the people in town rise up against the devil, and there you have it, Toxic Avenger 3, which leads us to Toxic Avenger 4, Citizen Toxie.
Which I have seen.
Yes, you have. So let's talk about this sequel. This is what we would call, I call the angry era Lloyd films. This came out in 2001. I think it was pre-9/11, yes. But it is definitely post-Columbine for that early scene in the front of the film.
Yeah, definitely, where we've got Trent Haga coming in as one of the diaper mafia people. So,
Tar dies every 5 minutes until a really real bikini TV crew arrives. You got that?
Got that.
I'm working on it. I swear, I'm working on it. But please, don't shoot any more of those cards. I mean those special kids.
Mark, the fucking tards! I'm sick and tired of that drooling wine. Now, why is it that when I shit my pants, it's a fucking social faux pas? But when some tard shits his pants, a good-looking nurse wipes his ass for him, huh? She's got a head of brass. Hey, stack. Check it out.
I love these awesome street gangs that are out there. Kind of reminded me of Monty Python with those rabid, with the, I almost said rabid grannies, with the gangs of old women who are going around and beating up young men. But yeah, these guys come in, they try to take over the school for special children. And that's where we meet a couple of our mainstay characters in this one. What's their name? Sweetie Honey or Sweetie Darling. And then really obnoxious, retarded kid. That was nice. And I do like the Citizen Toxie, you know, subtitle, and that we do get a newsreel for no reason whatsoever, because we've had news guys kind of leading us through this entire story. And then all of a sudden they cut to this old school newsreel where it's obviously an homage to the news on the march newsreel of Citizen Kane, even to the point where Ron Jeremy, the mayor, has a stately manner. What's it, Tromadou or something? Yeah.
Which was actually the Playboy Mansion.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Lloyd actually shot in the Playboy Mansion, and Hugh Hefner was in it, but he got cut from the film.
Oh, yeah, I do like that they have this kind of stunt casting going on in here, with where we've got, you know, the karate expert Ron Jeremy, we've got Al Goldstein in here, we've got Hank the Angry Dwarf showing up in a very special role. So it was nice to see some of these folks up here.
And speaking of, once again, satire of greed, a satire of environmentalism a little bit, satire of media and how media works within the confines of things like the Columbine Massacre. But that whole thing with, there's really two places where Lloyd's really sort of hammering home this concept of church-state separation that I really like. There's the scene in the massacre scene in the school where Toxie's going to head crush this kid and he's got a copy of the U.S. Government book in one hand and a Bible in the other. And bam, he hits the kid. And right before he does, there's a line from Debbie Rochon, who plays the teacher, and she's like,
"No, Toxie! Church and state must remain separated!"
And then Ron Jeremy, who plays the mayor, is just such an opportunist, and it's so good to have him and Al Goldstein. And Al Goldstein really doesn't have a lot to say in the film, but to have both of them playing like the mayor and his sort of, I guess, like Karl Rove-esque advisor in that scene is great.
How do you feel about the five very special people who are dead?
Try not to harp about the five that are dead. Think about the hundreds of students that are still living, still breathing. And let's pray for an end to all this murder and mayhem and garbage. Let's pray.
I'm not a $500, John.
Pray.
$150.
Get off the phone. Get off. Get off. Off. Let's pray. Let's pray, goddammit. You too. Oh, Lord, in your divine wisdom, please find it in your heart to put an end to all this murder and filth and trash and garbage. Oh, and please help us to get reelected one more term, okay? Thank you very much, God. Amen.
Amen. So it's great. I mean, it's just a lot of fun to watch. It's really crazy. There's this whole sort of like alternate universe thing where there's also an evil Toxic Avenger, and they sort of like trade roles. There's also like an evil Sergeant Kabuki Man, and there's sort of this space-time continuum rift kind of thing. And it's great to see James Gunn sort of like playing a Stephen Hawking-esque character trying to explain these like alternate universes and what it all means.
As you can plainly see, for every dimension there exists a diametric opposite of that dimension. When two explosions of equal mass occur simultaneously, the barrier between Tromaville and its dimensional doppelganger in Mortville was weakened for a moment. This breach caused the Toxic Avenger and his evil opposite, the Noxious Offender, to enter each other's reality.
Right, and how he manages to keep his penis erect.
Because that's important.
Yes. So yeah, in this one, there is kind of, you get both Sarah and Claire as Toxie's girlfriends. So you have both names, I think, going on with this one.
Yep.
So that was good. I don't know if we're to assume then that Toxic Avenger 2 and 3 actually take place in an alternate universe, or if somehow his girlfriend got shifted to this other universe and we've gotten this other one, but no one is aware that she's changed her name.
I also like the fact that in the alternate universe, instead of her being blind, she's a mute.
Right. She's deaf instead, yeah. And I like the very handy deaf translator, the topless deaf translator down in the lower corner, who just sits there and eats pizza.
Yeah, there's all kinds of stuff like that in these movies. And of course, the most obvious reference to Citizen Kane, I absolutely love, as you talked a little bit about, is that News on the March newsreel and the riff from Rosebud to
Noseblood.
Nose blood.
There you go. a coked out noxious offender, as they call him in the alternate
right universe. Yeah, and I do like the alternate Sergeant Kabuki Man with his hair kind of down and everything. I think he looks a lot cooler with that kind of look. But I do have to say, you know, this is kind of, I mean, I kind of got used to the idea of Toxic Avenger being, you know, it being pretty I don't know, raunchy and kind of raw and gross. I mean, the kid getting his head cut off, the mayor getting his entrails, you know, shown to him, basically. But there were things going on in Toxic Avenger 4 where it just feels like it doesn't feel like it's being done all the way right a lot of times. There are times where it's like the scene will cut and it's like, wow, you cut that like before the joke was finished kind of thing, or just it just feels like it's a really raw around the edges. Just, I don't know, it seems like the filmmaking would actually get better as the years go on, but it feels even more rough than the first one. And I don't know why that is. I don't know if it's, you know, that it's Lloyd kind of on his own doing the direction and no Michael Herz anymore. I don't know how much he brought to the table, but yeah, it's just kind of weird in that way. And then there are just some goofy things in there where I was just like kind of groaning inside while I was watching it. Like his ward, Lardass. Is it Lardass?
Yeah, it's Lardass.
Okay. Where it's like every time he's on screen, they always play like these farty noises and stuff. And it's just like, oh, come on. You know, just because a guy's fat, you're really morbidly obese, it's like you got to play like farty noises and stuff. It just felt very, I don't know, sophomoric a lot of times. But whatever. I handled it and I went on from there. So I think I'll be open to seeing more trauma as we go along.
Sounds good. But at least there's a big budget Hollywood remake.
Yes.
Let's
we can reboot the Toxic Avenger.
Of all the movies that I heard that were going to be remade, I couldn't believe that they were going to make the Toxic Avenger.
Well, you know, the story's kind of timeless. It holds up after all these years, and why not? Why not put all kinds of CGI and make that transformation just, you know, something that people will remember for the ages, kind of like David turning into a werewolf in American Werewolf in London. You know, the people will always look back at the transformation of the Toxic Avenger in this new film.
But from the stories I have read, though, Mike, I heard that the Hollywood remake, which looks like it could be 2014 or so before we actually see it, is definitely going to try and gear towards a PG-13, which to me sounds a little strange, considering obviously there'd be bullying in it if they go with the original concept. There's, you know, horrible disfigurements of a character, and I'm sure the head crushing won't be in there. But then again, you know, this isn't the first time that the Toxic Avenger has been sort of watered down a little bit in order to make him palatable for kids. This is a movie that features, as we talked about before, you turned it off with the kid getting his head crushed by a car and people taking photos of it and masturbating to it. And then they made a kid's cartoon out of this.
Toxic Crusaders, Toxic Crusaders. I had no friends, no girls that hugged me till I got radioactive ugly. Toxic Crusaders, Toxic.
Right. Well, geez. I mean, over the last, month now, we've talked about Rambo, with one of the most violent movies, and then Toxic Avenger, pretty darn violent, too. And then you've got both of them spawning kid shows. It's like, what were they thinking back then?
Well, not only kid shows, but toys. They make toys out of both of these things. And they make comic books, too, for kids. You know, Marvel put out a series of comic books on Toxic Avenger. I'm not saying that you can't do this and do it in a great way and all that stuff and then be awesome. But the idea that you're actually going to take something and gear towards kids that comes out of this is really kind of, it's kind of cynical or strange to me. Or maybe it's just because there's a name recognition to it that it's like, oh, well, if we create this, there's already a built-in name recognition because the kids' parents will have seen the first movie and then be like, oh, okay, I'm familiar with this. But then again, if you're the kids' parents who have seen this movie and then you're like, oh, I'm familiar with this, here, go play with the toys and watch the cartoon show, aren't you remembering the fact that they kill a kid in this film in a really gruesome way?
Yeah. I mean, and too, we had talked, RoboCop was an earlier show that we had done too, and it's like, yeah, it's like maybe the parents remember, oh yeah, RoboCop, I know that name, but don't they remember, you know, the guy getting shot up with, you know, 60, 70 squibs across the table and stuff, or Emil, you know, another toxic waste victim who gets that dumped on him and then he splatters all over the front of the van. It's like, come on, guys. You know, and I know that they're going to do this reboot and some idiot kid who's getting bullied is going to try to find some toxic waste to pour all over himself so he can get his revenge.
Oh, if only, if only. But Toxie actually has had his revenge in a lot of ways. I mean, he's lasted over 25 years now. And not only that, an award-winning musical has been based on The Toxic Avenger.
I've done every test that exists. I've probed every last orifice. And there is only one thing that I know. This ain't covered by your HMO. And my diagnosis is unique. You're a big green freak.
Yeah, it seems that that's the new hallmark for what makes a cult classic is, can we turn it into a musical? Because we've got the Evil Dead musical, we've got the Last Starfighter musical, we'll be talking to about the Last Starfighter in a few months, and we've got Toxie, and I'm sure there's a ton of others, you know, Silence of the Lambs, of course, but, you know, what are some of these other cult films that have kind of spawned musical adaptations? And Toxie's one of them, definitely.
As we talked about here in Detroit, they RoboCop the musical.
Yeah, exactly. Going to see that in a couple weeks. So I can't wait to see what kind of heartfelt songs we're going to be getting out of Murphy and Ann Lewis.
You know, Mike, when I came on the projection booth, I wanted to talk about these trauma films. Obviously, like I said, they're close to my heart because the people at the company and Lloyd Kaufman's close to my heart. So it's hard for me to judge them somewhat harshly sometimes. But overall, if you were going to take in the Toxic Avenger and obviously Citizen Toxie, so if you were going to sort of go, you know, what do you think? If I've never had a chance to see the Toxic Avenger, the first one, and then obviously this, the real sequel, part four, what would you say to the folks?
Oh, yeah, I definitely recommend it. You know, I would just kind of preface it with a little, it's, you know, kind of gross out here and there. And, you know, but otherwise, and maybe it's the wisdom of age that I have, but now I can now handle it and be okay. And it's such a time capsule of the 80s that it's really fun to look back at now and see some of the hairstyles, the music. I mean, that I Want to Hear Your Body Talk or whatever song. Very cool. And that will get you into your head forever.
And I was going to say, if it wasn't for the Toxic Avenger, probably USA Up All Night and Gilbert Gottfried would not become, you know, the cult classic that it was as well.
Right.
Because it was on there all the time.
All right, we're going to take a break and play a preview from next week's show.
Name, Kowalski. Occupation, driver. Transporting a supercharged Dodge Challenger from Denver to San Francisco. Background, Medal of Honor in Vietnam. Former stock and bike racer. Former cop, dishonorably discharged. Now he uses speed to get himself up, to get himself gone. Everybody's after Kowalski.
Because you think we're queers.
For one reason or another.
Is there something I can do for you?
Well, like what?
Like anything you want.
Everybody wants a piece of his hide.
Maybe kill somebody. Maybe stole that big dude of his. Maybe both.
They want to get him and put him away, but they'll have to catch him first.
Ah, good morning, folks! This is yours truly, Super Duper Soul, directed live transmission from K-O-W, with the wham, bam, boom, boom, wake up music!
The Challenger being chased by the blue meanies on wheels, the vicious traffic squad cars are after our lone driver, the super driver of the Golden West. The police numbers are getting closer to our sole hero in his sole mobile. They're gonna get him, smash him, rip the last American hero.
It's the maximum trip at maximum speed. Vanishing point.
That was a preview from next week's film, Vanishing Point. I wish I could speak like that guy. We're going to be talking with co-host Colin Gallagher. We want to thank this week's special guest interview, Lloyd Kaufman, for spending some time with us. For Troma fans, there's something super cool happening in L.A. this week, correct, Rob?
That's correct. Troma, best known for New York City, going to L.A. for something really cool. Cast reunion screening of Tromeo and Juliet actually taking place tomorrow, because this comes out on Wednesday. On Thursday, June 28th, at the New Beverly Cinema in L.A. That's going to be a great time. I wish I was out there. I'm going to kind of put some friends I know in emotional headlocks and maybe get them to go out there and tell us a little bit about Tromeo and Juliet, because here's a secret. We're going to be talking about that one coming up sometime this year. That's right. We're going to give the bird to the bard, as Lloyd did in Tromeo and Juliet, and that's going to be a lot of fun. But also coming up on Saturday, July 7th, here in Detroit, closer to home, at least for us, we'll be doing a live show, The Projection Booth. That's right. Come on down to the Corktown Cinema, the drive-in double feature, the cinema barbecue of Mothra and Equinox. So come and be part of it. And it'll be a lot of fun. We have some interviews that we're doing. We're putting that whole show together right now. And pretty much as soon as the Cinema Barbecue drive-in double feature of Mothra and Equinox is over, we will have a special show just for you that will include some live elements. So sort of expanding out on what we do here at the Projection Booth all the time, trying to do something interesting. As always, thanks for listening. Be sure to stop by our website, projection-booth.com. Also a Facebook page out there. You can follow us on Twitter as well. We love hearing your reviews and seeing your ratings on iTunes. That's a way actually to help the Projection Booth to grow, is to go to iTunes and make sure to give us a 5-star rating, because we're worth it, and say something nice about us, because not only will we grow big and strong, but we'll continue to be hideous as well, because that's the face of podcasting, in case you didn't know. Really hideous people hiding behind microphones in their basements. But then again, we want to be the best overall film review podcast there is around. We know we do a really good job. We always love to hear from you when it comes to the shows and what you appreciate, if you have ideas. And then also, one more thing, because there's always one more thing, Mike, right?
Yes.
Blade Runner.
Yes.
We need you to talk to us about Blade Runner. Tell us what we need to know about Blade Runner.
Exactly. Tell us, do you like the voiceover? Do you hate it? Do you like the unicorn? Do you make little origami figures and leave them for people and just kind of, you know, taunt them? What? How do you feel about Blade Runner and a possible sequel? Now that you've seen Prometheus and seen what Ridley Scott can do with revisiting his material from all those years ago, what do you think a Blade Runner sequel is going to be like? So go ahead, leave us a voicemail at 734-666-0800. And we will use it on our show all about Blade Runner, which will be coming up sometime before the end of 2012.
Once again, from yours truly, Rob St. Mary and Mike White and the Projection Booth, did we say thanks for listening.
Here's the Better Living Through Chemistry.
Cheers.
I feel the blood rushing through your veins. Sisters function at their peak.
Also,
I can't take it, Julie. I cannot take it. He is screwing up my karma.